Good evening, everyone, from Dominican University of California. It's another night of the Institute for Leadership Studies 2013 Lecture Series, November 7th, 2013, with Billy Collins. Coming up tonight, as Mr. Collins graces the stage right here at Angelico Concert Hall, Dominican University of California. Please stay with us.
Hi, I'm Elaine Petrocelli, and it's my privilege to be the president of Book Passage, your local community-owned bookstore. Book Passage is very lucky because people like you continue to support us and keep us here. And about 10 years ago, we really became lucky because we were invited to join a partnership with Dr. Denise Lucy and the Dominican Institute for Leadership Studies. And from the very first lecture, we have just had the best time together. We're especially privileged tonight because Random House, the publisher of Billy Collins' books, has enthusiastically brought him to Dominican. And the reason a Random House publisher told me yesterday is because the people who come here buy books. So it's all about the poetry. My poetic job is to ask everyone to please turn off your cell phones. And I'd appreciate if you don't flash during the... I've been hanging out with a poet. I'm getting very confused. At any rate, so it is very distracting to the author, and also, so keep your clothes on. We'd appreciate it if no one records this event, other than someone who's doing it officially. And Mr. Collins will read and talk to us, and then I have given him the questions on cards that people have filled out, and he is going to look them over and answer some of them. So I will turn this over soon to the wonderful people from Dominican and Private Ocean, and I just thank you all for being here. Thanks.
Welcome to Dominican's Leadership Lecture Series. In partnership with Book Passage, San Francisco and Marin's own independent bookstore. My name is Leanne Bartolini. I'm a professor here of psychology. I'm also a 10-year board member of Dominican's Institute for Leadership Studies. The series tonight is a program of the Institute of Leadership Studies, a center for leadership development offering education and training for students and professionals to become better leaders. The Institute also hosts public forums like this one to engage students, the campus, the community in socially relevant discussions and to highlight inspired acts of leadership across the disciplines. This live performance tonight will also be aired on Dominican's website at dominican.edu/leadership, as a podcast on Dominican Penguin Radio, and aired on Wednesdays at 8 p.m. on Channel 30 Public TV. I'm really thrilled to be on stage tonight to welcome you. I am a fan of poetry, of reading, and occasionally attempting to write. I adore the humor that Billy Collins brings to his work and his keen ability to focus our attention on the small but essential moments of life. Tonight, our lead diamond sponsor for this year's lecture series is Private Ocean, a personal, powerful wealth management company, one of the oldest and largest privately held wealth management firms in Marin. They've been named 7 times by Worth Magazine as one of the top 100 registered investment advisors nationwide and 2013 Best Wealth Management Firm by North Bay Biz. On behalf of the university, I would like to express our gratitude to Private Ocean for its community-oriented and generous support of the Leadership Lecture Series in partnership with Book Passage. Joining us this evening to introduce our program is Dr. Susan Duval Dixon. Dr. Dixon is a partner and chief operating officer of Private Ocean Wealth Management. Susan has more than 35 years' experience in business management. She reflects Private Ocean's community service values, serving in leadership roles on many, many nonprofit boards. Susan is also a Dominican alumna and also serves as an adjunct faculty in Dominican School of Business and Leadership. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Duval Dixon.
Good evening, everyone. I'm really excited tonight to introduce our guest speaker, Billy Collins. Billy Collins has taught us how to fall in love with poetry. He has captured moments like tripping on a shoelace or making a lanyard at camp and shown us the true beauty of these small acts. He's reminded us of the wit, the wisdom, and the heart that can be found in the written word. Called the most popular poet in America by Bruce Weber of the New York Times, Billy Collins is certainly deserving of this title. I wanted to add that this week, Billy's current book is on the New York top 15 fiction books, so New York Times, so this is awesome. Mr. Collins has served the country as United States Poet Laureate from 2001 to 2003. It was in this capacity that he read his poem, The Names, at a special joint session of Congress to commemorate the victims of 9/11. Most recently, Mr. Collins appeared at a recital at the White House hosted by First Lady Michelle Obama and Dr. Jill Biden. In a characteristic display of versatility, Mr. Collins followed this event with appearances on both NPR's Wait, Don't Tell Me, and Garrison Keillor's Prairie Home Companion. That Mr. Collins can capture the solemnity and the dignity of profound occasions without ever losing a sense of whimsy and light truly sets him apart. It is no doubt this special quality that earned him the first Mark Twain Prize for Humor in Poetry, as well as fellowships from the New York Foundation of the Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts, along with the Guggenheim Foundation. Mr. Collins once said that a good poem begins in Kansas and ends in Oz. I'll be excited to see where his first appearance at Angelica Hall will take us as we celebrate Aimless Love, his first volume of new and selected poetry in 12 years. Please join me in welcoming Billy Collins.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for that introduction. Yeah, it's really it's very good to be here, and it's very good to know that this book, Aimless Love, has gotten onto that Times, New York Times bestseller list. I mean, that would be good in any universe, but it's particularly good because they put it on the fiction list, because there's no list for poetry. So I've actually broken into the clubhouse containing John Grisham, Nicholas Sparks, Don DeLillo, the big cigar-puffing prose writers. So Little Aimless Love is just squeezed right in there, and it's part of the club. So it's moving, it's apparently moving up to number 12. So John Grisham, watch your back. So it's exciting to have the book out, and there is also a pleasure in not having the book out. That is to say, Someone said that every author has the same favorite word, and the word is forthcoming, because all things are possible. And in poetry circles, this period, this pre-publication period, is also known as the calm before the calm. So small C and then capital C. So, all good. So I'm going to read some poems and say a little bit about them. And then I have some questions in my pocket here, which I haven't looked at, but we'll look at those. So I'm going to start with a poem that is more or less about the reader. Writing poetry for me is a pleasantly solitary activity. I don't have an MFA. I've never taken a workshop. My dear friend Kay Ryan, who is you're lucky enough to have as a neighbor, like me, she taught most of her life in a not-so-prestigious college, as I did in New York City. And we both came to some kind of recognition, I would say, later in life. And she also never took a workshop. And she actually said to me at one point that taking a workshop in writing would be like an invasion of privacy, which I thought was spot on, because I think I got into poetry as an adolescent, not just because it was something to do by yourself, but it was something to do with your aloneness, you know, with your solitude. It was a way of articulating your solitude. But solitude can only go so far. One of the things I enjoy is having the illusion, as I'm writing, of the company of a reader who is into whose hands this poem might fall. So most of my books are prefaced by a poem which is talking to the reader. And this is one of those I'll start with. It has an epigraph from William Butler Yeats, not from a poem, but from a piece of prose, and it expresses his extremely elevated and exalted view of the role of the poet in the world. A highly uncommon kind of elevation. So the epigraph is, he says, the poet or a poet never speaks directly as to someone at the breakfast table, God forbid. And in another instance, I underlined this in my book, he says, the poet is never that bundle of accident and incoherence that sits down to breakfast. So he apparently had something against breakfast. Something embarrassing about the informality of that meal, even though we know today it's the most important meal of the day. So as you can imagine, my poem takes issue with that highly rarefied idea of the poet. And it's called A Portrait of the Reader with a Bowl of Cereal. Every morning I sit across from you at the same small table, the sun all over the breakfast things, curve of a blue and white pitcher, a dish of berries, me in a sweatshirt or robe, you invisible. Most days we are suspended over a deep pool of silence. I stare straight through you, or look out the window at the garden, the powerful sky, a cloud passing behind a tree. There is no need to pass the toast, the pot of jam, or pour you a cup of tea, and I can hide behind the paper, rotate, in its drum of calamitous news. But some days, I may notice a little door swinging open in the morning air, and maybe the tea leaves of some dream will be stuck to the china slope of the hour. Then I will lean forward, elbows on the table, with something to tell you, and you will look up, as always, your spoon dripping milk, ready to listen. So that's it's a quaint. Now, I wanted to read a few poems for you English majors out there. That's right. English majors are not afraid to express themselves. A poem from the new book called A Lesson for the Day. I didn't know Marianne Moore had written a little ode to a steamroller until this morning. She has it walking back and forth over the particles it has crushed. She must have watched a lot of cartoons. She also compares it to a butterfly unflatteringly. I like it better when she speaks to a snail. It is pleasurable to picture her in a garden, bending forward in her dated black clothes and her tilted black triangle of a hat as she seriously addresses the fellow curled in his shell. But when I see her standing before the big drum of a steamroller and saying not very nice things, only one eventuality ever comes to mind. For I, too, am a serious student of cartoons. And no one wants to avoid seeing a flattened Marianne Moore hanging out to dry on a clothesline or propped up as a display in a store window more than I. I used to think of these poets with such reverence, you know, and I guess I've just outgrown all that. Because here's another one. This is called A Note to Thomas Stearns Eliot, T.S. Eliot, as he called himself. Note to Thomas Stearns Eliot. I just dared to eat a really big peach that could not be more ripe, and I have on a pair of plaid shorts and a blue T-shirt with a hole in it, and rivulets of peach juice are running down my chin now and dripping onto the pool deck. What is your problem, man? All right, and then it's like talking back, sassing him a little bit. And this is more in a minor key, but it's and the title is important. It's called The Widower. This is just to say, this morning, I ate the plums that I had been saving for breakfast. So, anyway, that's that's enough for you English majors. And here's a poem for everybody. It's from an earlier book, and it's called Another Reason I Don't Keep a Gun in the House. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. He is barking the same high rhythmic bark that he barks every time they leave the house. They must switch him on their way out. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. I close all the windows in the house and put on a Beethoven symphony, full blast. But I can still hear him, muffled under the music, barking, barking, barking. And now I can see him sitting in the orchestra, his head raised confidently as if Beethoven had included a part for Barking Dog. When the record finally ends, he is still barking, sitting there in the oboe section, barking, his eyes fixed on the conductor, who is entreating him with his baton, while the other musicians listen in respectful silence to the famous Barking Dog solo. That endless coda that first established Beethoven as an innovative genius. Thank you. Well, here's something that came up at the little reception, I think. This is something that, you know, I know people who write short stories and even a few people who write, oh, wow, nice. If someone just get me a folding chair, I'll just sit there and look at that. Looks good. I pick all my covers, you know. I don't know why they've let me do that, but the art department, you know, I thought at first it would be like going into the kitchen and telling the chef, you should put a little more salt in here, you know, and they come after you with a cleaver, but they've always been very good about it. So I've designed, I mean, they kind of give the design, but they run it by me. And in this case, I could not find a suitable cover for this book. And it doesn't have anything to do with the title or anything, really. But as soon as I looked frantically online, going through banks of images, and I found that one. It just seemed absolutely perfect. I can't explain why, but I just think it's very odd. And he's looking right at you. You just don't know what he's thinking. But anyway, so this is a poem. I'll try not to look over my shoulder. This is something, as I was saying, this is something that poets get all the time and other writers, I'm quite sure, don't get. And it's called the suggestion box. It all began fairly early in the day at the coffee shop, as it turned out, when the usual waitress said, "I bet you're going to write a poem about this," after she had knocked a cup of coffee into my lap. Then later in the morning, I was told by a student that I should write a poem about the fire drill that was going on as we all stood on the lawn outside our building. In the afternoon, a woman I barely knew said, "You could write a poem about that," pointing to a dirigible that was passing slowly overhead. And if all that were not enough, a friend turned to me as we walked past a man whose face was covered with tattoos and said, "I see a poem coming." Why is everyone being so helpful? I wondered that evening by the shore of a lake. Maybe I should write a poem about all the people who think they know what I should be writing poems about. It was just then, in the fading light, that I spotted a pair of ducks emerging from a cluster of reeds to paddle out to open water. The female glancing back over her russet shoulder, just in time to see me searching my pockets for a pen. "I knew it," she quacked, with a bit of a brogue. "But who can blame you for following your heart?" she went on. "Now go write a lovely poem about me and the mister." That's probably why they put it on the fiction list and not the nonfiction list, because it has talking Irish female ducks in it. And here's a little poem called Cheerios. One bright morning, most of these poems take place in restaurants, as you can see. One bright morning in a restaurant in Chicago, as I waited for my eggs and toast, I opened the Tribune only to discover that I was the same age as Cheerios. Indeed, I was a few months older than Cheerios, for today, the newspaper announced, was the 70th birthday of Cheerios, whereas mine had occurred earlier in the year. Already I could hear them whispering behind my stooped and threadbare back, "Why, that dude's older than Cheerios." The way they used to say, "Why, that's as old as the hills." Only the hills are much older than Cheerios or any American breakfast cereal. And more noble and enduring are the hills, I surmised, as a bar of sunlight illuminated my orange juice. Thanks. And here's... this is a poem that starts, anyway, with a big annual migratory event, and it's called The Sand Hill Cranes of Nebraska. "Too bad you weren't here 6 months ago," was a lament I heard on my visit to Nebraska. "You could have seen the astonishing spectacle of the Sand Hill Cranes, thousands of them feeding and even dancing on the shores of the Platte River." There was no point in pointing out the impossibility of my being there then because I happened to be somewhere else, so I nodded and put on a look of mild disappointment, if only to be part of the commiseration. It was the same look I remember wearing about 6 months ago in Georgia when I was told that I had just missed the spectacular annual outburst of azaleas, brilliant against the green backdrop of spring. And the same in Vermont 6 months before that, when I arrived shortly after the magnificent foliage had gloriously peaked, Mother Nature, as she is called, having touched the hills with her many-colored brush, a phenomenon that occurs, like the others, around the same time every year, when I am apparently off in another state, stuck in a motel lobby with the local newspaper and a styrofoam cup of coffee, busily missing God knows what. Thanks. I had a little help with that poem from, although he was long dead, but from Howard Nemiroff, wonderful poet and a former poet laureate himself. He made up a number of us were asked some years ago to make up a new word. And it was the idea of this new dictionary was not humor or silliness. It was not like sniglets or something like that, if you remember those. But we were actually asked to see if we could identify a hole in the language, a place where there should be a word and there isn't, and to fill it. And Howard Nemiroff, I thought, had the best word in the dictionary. He made up the verb, transitive verb, to azaleate. To azaleate someone means to commiserate needlessly with some visitor about a local phenomenon that they just missed because they arrived too late, or they will miss because they're leaving too early. So Howard Nemiroff is also the author of my very favorite two-line poem called Bacon and Eggs. The chicken contributes, but the pig gives his all. Shorter than a tweet, probably. One thing that poets tend to do is, one of the respected activities, you might say, is to be so enamored of a previous poem or to be so engaged by it that the poet wants to write his or her own version of that older poem. And there can be a variety of spirits into which one jumps into that activity. It can be a kind of homage to the previous poet, a sort of respectful updating. It can involve a trespass and even delinquency. But regardless of the spirit, the protocol for doing this is the same. And it involves two things. First of all, you use the same title as the previous poem, and then under the title, off to the right, you write the expression after, and then the name of the original poet. So you'd have after Neruda, you're familiar with this, at least the English majors are, or after Whitman or whatever. So I wanted to, that's all a long way to say that I wanted to write a poem, a version of a lovely poem by the Chinese poet Li Po. And his poem is called Drinking Alone. And so I dutifully wrote Drinking Alone on a piece of paper, under it, after Li Po. And then I just stared at the title, and then I stared at after Li Po for a long time. Drinking Alone after Li Po. This is not after Li Po the way the state is after me for neglecting to pay all my taxes. Nor the way I am after the woman in front of me on the long line at the post office. Li Po, I am not saying after you as I stand holding open one of the heavy glass doors that divide the centuries in a long corridor of glass doors. No, the only way this is after you is in the way they say it's just one thing after another. Like the way I will pause to raise a glass of wine to you after I finish writing this poem. So let me get back to sitting in the wind alone among the pines with a pencil in my hand. After all, you had your turn, and mine will soon be done. Then someone else will sit here after me. So that worked out okay. Not at all what I had in mind, but... So a poem about, on the subject of adolescence. I once had I still have a friend, but he once had his two daughters. He still has them. Let me say how to phrase this. His two daughters were at some point teenagers. And I remember distinctly ending a phone call with him by asking him, and how are the girls? And he said, they're committing adolescence. So this is a response to that phenomenon, and it's called To My Favorite 17-Year-Old High School Girl. Do you realize that if you had started building the Parthenon on the day you were born, you would be all done in only one more year? Of course, you couldn't have done that alone, so never mind. You're fine just as you are. You are loved for simply being yourself. But did you know that at your age, Judy Garland was pulling down $150,000 a picture? Joan of Arc was leading the French army to victory? And Blaise Pascal had cleaned up his room? No, wait, I mean he had invented the calculator. Of course, there will be time for all that later in your life, after you come out of your room and begin to blossom, or at least pick up all your socks. For some reason, I keep remembering that Lady Jane Grey was Queen of England when she was only 15, but then she was beheaded, so never mind her as a role model. But a few centuries later, when he was your age, Franz Schubert was doing the dishes for his family, but that did not keep him from composing two symphonies, four operas, and two complete masses as a youngster. But of course, that was in Austria at the height of Romantic lyricism, not here in the suburbs of Cleveland. Frankly, who cares if Annie Oakley was a crack shot at 15, or if Maria Callas debuted as Tosca at 17? We think you are special. We think you are special by just being you, playing with your food and staring into space. By the way, I lied about Schubert doing the dishes, but that doesn't mean he never helped out around the house. Now, in the South, you're supposed to say, bless her heart, so bless her teenage heart. Here's a little poem about a dog. It's only 12 lines long. I remember when I usually will tell you if it's that short, if it's under like a sonnet length, because I remember, or I'll never forget reading a little essay by Philip Larkin where he explained several reasons why he didn't like to attend poetry readings. I'm not going to tell you more than one because you might get second thoughts about even being here. But he said, one of the drawbacks of attending a reading is that you never know where the poem's going to end. So when you're holding a poem in your hand, you can see the ending coming and you can get emotionally prepared for that. So this is 12 lines long, and it's a dog who's considering a fact that goes along with his domesticity. It's called A Dog on His Master. As young as I look, I am growing older faster than he. 7 to 1 is the ratio, they tend to say. Whatever the number, I will pass him one day and take the lead the way I do on our walks in the woods. And if this ever manages to cross his mind, it would be the sweetest shadow I have ever cast on snow or grass. Now, (clears throat) So, you know, you made a little sound there, which is fine. It's fine. But that sound usually indicates something. It indicates that the poem has lost ironic traction and has slid into a ditch of sentimentality. But which seems unavoidable in poems about house creatures, like dogs particularly. And that's why I set out, very intentionally to write a poem about a dog that would not create that sound, or that that was, as best as I could make it, dried up of that kind of moisture. And so the title is The Revenant, and that means, as you probably know, a visitor from beyond, the revenant. I am the dog you put to sleep, as you like to call the needle of oblivion, come back to tell you this simple thing. I never liked you. When I licked your face, I thought of biting off your nose. When I watched you toweling yourself dry, I wanted to leap and unman you with a snap. I resented the way you moved, your lack of animal grace, the way you would sit in a chair to eat, a napkin on your lap, a knife in your hand. I would have run away, but I was too weak, a trick you taught me while I was learning to sit and heal, and greatest of insults, shake hands without a hand. I admit the sight of the leash would excite me, but only because it meant I was about to smell things you had never touched. You do not want to believe this, but I have no reason to lie. I hated the car, hated the rubber toys, disliked your friends, and worse, your relatives. The jingling of my tags drove me mad. You always scratched me in the wrong place. All I ever wanted from you was food and fresh water in my metal bowls. While you slept, I watched you breathe as the moon rose in the sky. It took all of my strength not to raise my head and howl. Now I am free of the collar, free of the yellow raincoat, monogram sweater, the absurdity of your lawn. And that is all you need to know about this place, except what you already supposed and are glad it did not happen sooner, that everyone here can read and write, the dogs in poetry, the cats and all the others in prose. So I've made my position clear on the dog-cat controversy. You know that I am voting along the dog ticket. Here's a couple of little poems. When I get a hold of a book of poems, I never read a book of poems from beginning to end. I don't think anyone does unless you're an editor or a reviewer. I just kind of use it as a flip book. I kind of go like this, and like I'm waiting for the cowboy to jump over his rope or something. But basically, I'm looking for a little poems. I like little poems as ways to get into a book. So here's a four-line poem, and the title is important. It's the title is Divorce. Once, two spoons in bed, now tined forks across a granite table, and the knives they have hired. That's the right sound for that poem. That's fine. And here's a nine-line poem. The narrator here is a very gullible, innocent fellow. And the title is, Oh My God. oh my God. Not only in church and nightly by their bedsides do young girls pray these days. Wherever they go, prayer is woven into their talk like a bright thread of awe. Even at the pedestrian mall, outbursts of praise spring unbidden from their glossy lips. Thanks. So poetry is probably the original use of poetry. If we stare back into the fog of prehistory, where we run out of any information, we can make an educated guess that poetry probably began as a mere mnemonic device, that what we associated with the kind of aesthetic and literary beauties or features of poetry, like rhyme and meter and alliteration and so forth, were really just a set of memory devices to memorize in a pre-literate culture information, which could be vital to your survival, like when to plant or where to hunt and that kind of thing, or essential to your identity. You know, who are you? What happened before your grandparents or the history of your tribe? So people with memory powers were powerful figures in those cultures. So once we had writing, and not only writing, but now we have digital recording devices for everything, poetry, the practical reason for poetry came to an end in a way, but of course it continues to keep people like me writing. But here's sometimes I write just to preserve something in memory, and this poem is a good example of something I observed and I just didn't want to forget it. And it, excuse me, it's called Love. The boy at the far end of the train car kept looking behind him as if he were afraid or expecting someone. And then she appeared in the glass door of the forward car, and he rose and opened the door and let her in. And she entered the car carrying a large black case in the unmistakable shape of a cello. She looked like an angel with a high forehead and somber eyes, and her hair was tied up behind her neck with a black bow. And because of all that, he seemed a little awkward in his happiness to see her, whereas she was simply there, perfectly existing as a creature with a soft face who played the cello. And the reason I am writing this on the back of a manila envelope, now that they have left the train together, is to tell you that when she turned to lift the large, delicate cello onto the overhead rack, I saw him looking up at her and what she was doing, the way the eyes of saints are painted when they are looking up at God, when he is doing something remarkable, something that identifies him as God. Sweet couple. A sweet couple. Didn't want to forget them. well, here's that poem that was mentioned in the introduction about something children do in the summertime to make their parents feel better about things. And a poem called The Lanyard that I try to start the poem with the way it occurred to me. The lanyard. The other day, as I was ricocheting slowly off the pale blue walls of this room, bouncing from typewriter to piano, from bookshelf to an envelope lying on the floor, I found myself in the L section of the dictionary, where my eyes fell upon the word lanyard. No cookie nibbled by a French novelist could send one more suddenly into the past. A past where I sat at a workbench, at a camp, by a deep Adirondack lake, learning how to braid thin plastic strips into a lanyard, a gift from my mother. I had never seen anyone use a lanyard or wear one if that's what you did with them, but that did not keep me from crossing strand over strand again and again until I had made a boxy red and white lanyard for my mother. She gave me life and milk from her breasts, and I gave her a lanyard. She nursed me in many a sick room, lifted teaspoons of medicine to my lips, set cold face cloths on my forehead, and then led me out into the airy light and taught me to walk and swim, and I in turn presented her with a lanyard. Here are thousands of meals, she said, and here is clothing and a good education. And here is your lanyard, I replied, which I made with a little help from a counselor. Here is a breathing body and a beating heart, strong legs, bones, and teeth, and two clear eyes to read the world, she whispered. And here, I said, is the lanyard I made at camp. And here, I wish to say to her now, is a smaller gift, not the archaic truth that you can never repay your mother, but the rueful admission that when she took the two-tone lanyard from my hands, I was as sure as a boy could be that this useless, worthless thing I wove out of boredom would be enough to make us even. Thank you. It was either that or the potholder. That was the other choice we had. It was a big deal. I didn't know which one to do. You chose right, my son. Here's a poem. I wrote a bunch of poems when I couldn't think of anything to write about, which has never stopped me in the past, but I really, really couldn't think of anything to write about or how to start, and I couldn't just not write, so what I would, I'd just grab a phrase off the radio or something I'd see in a book, and I'd say, let's just say that's the title of a poem, and then what possible poem could take place under that. So I'll give you one example from that period, that dark period. It's called Hippos on Holiday. Hippos on Holiday is really not the title of a movie, but if it were, I would be sure to see it. I love their short legs and big heads, the whole hippo look. Hundreds of them would frolic in the mud of a wide, slow-moving river, and I would eat my popcorn in the dark of a neighborhood theater. When they opened their enormous mouths, lined with big stubby teeth, I would drink my enormous Coke. I would be both in my seat and in the water playing with the hippos, which is the way it is with a truly great movie. Only a mean-spirited reviewer would ask, on holiday from what? I wish I could write more of those poems. Here's a poem called, it's a title poem from an earlier book. It's called The Trouble with Poetry. And don't worry, it's not that long, because it's not about all the troubles with poetry. It's just one of the troubles, one of the many troubles. The trouble with poetry. The trouble with poetry, I realized as I walked along a beach one night, cold Florida sand under my bare feet, a show of stars in the sky. The trouble with poetry is that it encourages the writing of more poetry, more guppies crowding the fish tank, more baby rabbits hopping out of their mothers into the dewy grass. And how will it ever end unless the day finally arrives when we have compared everything in the world to everything else in the world? And there is nothing left to do then but quietly close our notebooks and sit with our hands folded on our desks. Poetry fills me with joy, and I rise like a feather in the wind. Poetry fills me with sorrow, and I sink like a chain flung from a bridge. But mostly, poetry fills me with the urge to write poetry, to sit in the dark and wait for a little flame to appear at the tip of my pencil. And along with that, the longing to steal, to break in to the poems of others with a flashlight and a ski mask. And what an unmerry band of thieves we are, cut purses, common shoplifters, I thought to myself as a cold wave swirled around my feet and the lighthouse moved its megaphone over the sea, which is an image I stole directly from Lawrence Ferlinghetti. To be perfectly honest for a moment, the bicycling poet of San Francisco, whose little amusement park of a book I used to carry in a side pocket of my uniform up and down the treacherous halls of high school. I would say thank you. I would say not that anyone asked, but that would be an example. I mean, a good example of not knowing where I'm going. I just thought I'd say there's too much poetry being written. I'd have fun with that. But and then what poems are really about is getting out of them. You know, finding a place to end, finding a place of mutual satisfaction, so that I don't want to say anymore, and you don't want to hear anymore. And in that case, Lawrence Ferlinghetti came to the rescue. You know, as soon as I stole that line from him, then suddenly decided I would just cop to that immediately and mentioned his name, then I knew that's where the poem ends. It ends with him. It ends with him bicycling to work in North Beach and me in high school with Coney Island of the Mind in my jacket pocket. So who knew it would end with a high school memory like that? But that's, I don't know if that qualifies as going from Kansas to Oz, but it qualifies, you know, there's no flying monkeys at the end there, but it qualifies from going from somewhere that I'm familiar with to somewhere that's actually very strange and new to me. All right, well, here's a poem I haven't read. Now I don't know the difference between reading and writing. So this is a takeoff on a love poem I found in a magazine, a love poem that did nothing but just reiterate the same tired old convention that male poets had and still have of trying to impress these their women with by comparing them endlessly to everything they can think of, right? These are male poets who presumed that they knew what women wanted. You know, that insulting question of Freud's, what do women want? But these poets knew. They knew that women did not want, passion or fidelity or respect or any of that. The women want similes. They want their metaphor-starved creatures. They sit there waiting for someone to compare them to stuff. So I'd had enough of that. And, you know, Shakespeare wrote that famous sonnet, my mistress's eyes are nothing like the sun, you know, subverting. You'd think that would put an end to this whole tradition. I mean, he sensed the ridiculous of us even in like 1601 or something. But it continues unabated. So here's your man in this magazine comparing the woman to everything he can think of. But he begins with these images. He says, you are the bread and the knife, the crystal goblet, and the wine. Is that nice, ladies? Like this guy already? Anyway, so I use the first two lines to start this poem called Litany. You are the bread and the knife, the crystal goblet and the wine. You are the dew on the morning grass and the burning wheel of the sun. You are the white apron of the baker and the marsh bird suddenly in flight. However, you are not the wind in the orchard, the plums on the counter, or the house of cards. And you are certainly not the pine-scented air. There is no way you are the pine-scented air. It is possible that you are the fish under the bridge, maybe even the pigeon on the general's head, but you are not even close to being the field of cornflowers at dusk. And a quick look in the mirror will show that you are neither the boots in the corner nor the boat asleep in its boathouse. It might interest you to know, speaking of the plentiful imagery of the world, that I am the sound of rain on the roof. I also happen to be the shooting star, the evening paper blowing down an alley, and the basket of chestnuts on the kitchen table. I am also the moon in the trees and the blind woman's teacup. But don't worry, I am not the bread and the knife. You are still the bread and the knife. You will always be the bread and the knife, not to mention the crystal goblet and somehow the wine. Thank you. Okay, here's a poem that expands into something I didn't expect it. I mean, that's the fun of writing poems, really, is or maybe writing anything, is having the pen, you know, take you somewhere that you didn't know you expected to go. So I'll read this and maybe one more poem, and then we can... We can have a little talk, maybe. So all I wanted to do in beginning this poem, innocently enough, with a kind of doodling, I wanted to just see if there was something to be written about that period, you know, when I was growing up, when and, of course, before I arrived, when men were in the habit of wearing fedora hats, in particularly in cities. It was almost mandatory. And the poem is called The Death of the Hat. Once every man wore a hat. In the ashen newsreels, the avenues of cities or broad rivers flowing with hats. The ballpark swelled with thousands of straw hats, brims and bands, rows of men smoking and cheering in shirt sleeves. Hats were the law. They went without saying. You noticed a man in a crowd without a hat. You bought them from Adams or Dobbs, who branded your initials in gold on the inside band. Trolleys crisscrossed the city. Steamships sailed in and out of the harbor. Men with hats gathered on the docks. There was a person to block your hat and a hat-check girl to mind it while you had a drink or ate a steak with peas and a baked potato. In your office stood a hat rack. The day war was declared, everyone in the street was wearing a hat. And they were wearing hats when a ship loaded with men and women sank in the icy sea. My father wore one to work every day and returned home carrying the evening paper, the winter chill radiating from his overcoat. But today we go bareheaded into the winter streets, stand hatless on frozen platforms. Today, the mailbox is on the roadside, and the spruce trees behind the house wear cold white hats of snow. Mice scurry from the stone walls at night in their thin fur hats to eat the birdseed that has spilled. And now my father, after a life of work, wears a hat of earth, and on top of that, a lighter one of cloud and sky, a hat of wind. Thank you very much, and I'll just end with this poem called Consolation. The circumstances here are, there was a kind of a little European summer vacation planned for my wife and I, and we, for one reason or another, it had to be canceled. So the summer was spent more or less hanging around the house in the suburbs of New York. And so I wrote the poem to console myself about that circumstance, which is why it's called Consolation. How agreeable it is not to be touring Italy this summer, wandering her cities and ascending her torrid hill towns. How much better to cruise these local familiar streets, fully grasping the meaning of every road sign and billboard, and all the sudden hand gestures of my compatriots. There are no abbeys here, no crumbling frescoes or famous domes, and there is no need to memorize a succession of kings or tour the dripping corners of a dungeon. No need to stand around a sarcophagus, see Napoleon's little bed on Elba, or view the bones of a saint under glass. How much better to command the simple precinct of home than be dwarfed by pillar, arch, and basilica? Why hide my head in phrase books and wrinkled maps? Why feed scenery into a hungry, one-eyed camera, eager to eat the world one monument at a time? Instead of slouching in a cafe, ignorant of the word for ice, I will head down to the coffee shop and to the waitress known as Dot. I will slide into the flow of the morning paper, all language barriers down, rivers of idiom running freely, eggs over easy on the way. And after breakfast, I will not have to find someone willing to photograph me with my arm around the owner. I will not puzzle over the bill or record in a journal what I had to eat and how the sun came in the window. It is enough to climb back into the car as if it were the great car of English itself, and sounding my loud vernacular horn, speed off down a road that will never lead to Rome, not even Bologna. Thank you.